Good evening, everyone. Welcome to tonight's teleseminar. My name is Dan Green. I will be substituting for Dr. Shamroff tonight as he is currently traveling from our recent California course. So look forward to speaking with you all tonight. By the way, before we start, I want to remind folks that the next teleseminar will be on September 18th, and I expect Dr. Shamroff will, in fact, be hosting that call. So we were fortunate that somebody did send in a question, so we will start off with it. It was the infamous Dr. Anonymous, so they didn't attach their name, which is perfectly fine. And the question was, how do you defend a hysterectomy on a patient who is less than 30 years old? The patient failed all medical management options for abnormal uterine bleeding and dysmenorrhea and wanted definitive treatment. So that is a great question. In fact, at the courses, we do try to cover that question in the GYN vignettes. But I think we'll go over it tonight in a little bit of detail because some folks may not have been able to attend the course or decided not to attend the course, and that's certainly fine. I am going to actually mute folks because we are getting some background noise. So you could just bear with me, and what I'll do is I'll unmute everybody after we do the presentation, and then feel free to ask questions about this, or in fact, if you have questions about anything else, be happy to take questions at that time. Now, if someone did send in this particular question and actually wants to talk about it, I'm not sure if there's a raise hand feature or if you guys are able to note that. So I apologize about that. Okay. So the question that comes in is actually, it's a great question. Many folks sitting for the exam have a hysterectomy, certainly under the age of 40. In fact, some of y'all will have hysterectomies under the age of, under the age of 35. And, of course, in this case with the question, the questioner had a concern about a patient under the age of 30. I've probably looked at least in terms of formal reviews, roughly about 50 lists this season, and certainly have seen a couple folks that have had multiple patients actually under the age of 30. Pardon me. Where it gets to be a little bit tricky is if you haven't listed things like medical management, you know, failed medical management, desires definitive treatment. I'm not saying it's an absolute must, but certainly having it down does help. If you have one case like this, you can usually explain it away. Where it gets to be a little bit tricky is for folks that have multiple patients that we would consider low-age hysterectomies. You know, under age 35 or certainly under age 30. And it really gets to be especially tricky if the candidate has not only multiple patients under the age of, let's say, 30 in this case, but those that don't really have significant pathology. And by significant pathology, I mean like, you know, endometriosis, adenomyosis, large leiomyomata, something, you know, but I've reviewed a couple lists where folks had multiple hysterectomies. The uterus weighed even less than 100 grams and didn't really have anything of note in the pathology. So it doesn't mean that the patient wasn't having pain or that the hysterectomy wasn't indicated, but it does make it much harder to defend and explain. You can imagine if you had a 29-year-old with a 800-gram leiomyomatous uterus, a lot easier to defend that than a 70-gram uterus that just shows proliferative endometrium, for example. All right, so let's talk about the best way to approach this subject. So, you know, the question, doctor, I see you have this patient who's 28 years old who had abnormal bleeding and dysmenorrhea. It says you ended up doing a hysterectomy on her. Don't you think that's a little bit young for a patient to undergo hysterectomy? So the first thing you want to do if that question comes up, and particularly if it's phrased like that, is you want to agree with the examiner. So you don't want to get defensive or argumentative or anything like that. You know, say, yeah, yes, I do think that this was a young patient for a hysterectomy. And the whole thing you want to convey, the overall impression you want to give is that that you didn't want to do it. I'm not saying that you thought it was inappropriate to do, but you struggled with the case. You know, this was a challenging case for me. I usually don't do such a dramatic procedure on a patient this young. But in this case, there were extenuating circumstances. So you want to explain the extenuating circumstances. You know, perhaps she had severe or disabling symptoms, you know, for the abnormal uterine bleeding. She had dysmenorrhea, so clearly her menses were obviously painful. But did she have any pelvic pain during the entire month? Did she have refractory endometriosis, or were you suspicious that there was endometriosis? This would not be the case necessarily in this particular patient, but did she have symptomatic leiomyomata? And again, it's important to emphasize, and I think the question came in this way, that the patient did fail medical management. So what medical management? Now, you don't have to try every single thing, but I would suggest that it would be reasonable, again, in general, to have tried multiple treatment options. I'm not talking about, when I say multiple, I don't mean 10 different things, but more than one. So perhaps birth control pills. If not that, you may have decided to try progesterone IUD, or maybe you gave her a shot of Depo-Provera. So those would all be possible things to consider. Other things you might consider, and I think this is a good thing, especially if you don't suspect any particular cause of the endometriosis, of the dysmenorrhea, and you'll see where I'm going with this in just a second, would be a trial of Lupron. So I'm not saying you have to try Lupron, but Lupron is a thing that you could try, and it gives more credence to the case if you tried Lupron on this patient. So let's say you have a patient. If she's got, you know, humongous fibroids, okay, she's got something clearly evident. Let's say you have done a laparoscopy on her already and you saw that she was riddled with endometriosis. Okay, you know that she's got a cause and have high likelihood that the hysterectomy is going to provide her some relief. But let's say, on the other hand, you did a laparoscopy maybe, you know, previously, you didn't see endometriosis. She doesn't have these big fibroids. You're really a little bit at a loss. What I'm getting at with the Lupron is, you know, you basically would take away her menses and you could get a sense of whether or not the patient had adequate relief, which would help to give you some sense that by doing the hysterectomy and relieving her of her, you know, menses each month is going to benefit her and she's going to have adequate relief. If, you know, taking away her menses with the Lupron, she's still having pelvic pain, that's concerning that she's still going to have residual pain, and obviously also would make you think, hey, you know, even though I queried her about a review of systems looking for GU, GI, musculoskeletal, and/or psychiatric components to her pain, you know, there might be something else here. So those are you know, different medical managements. Again, please don't take home from this that I'm saying you have to try Lupron before you do a hysterectomy. I'm just saying if you did try it, you know, in a case like this and the patient got relief, you know, that is an extra bonus because it's something that you can bring up during the test to help, again, reassure you that at least you're going to be doing the right thing for the patient and she's going to have improvement. Okay, so other things to emphasize if you're defending a low-H hysterectomy, you know, that you have a good relationship with the patient, but more than that, even that you have a again, I'm air quoting here since you can't see me, but a long-standing relationship with the patient. I say long-standing because, I mean, how long-standing a relationship really can you have? Most of you are, you know, 1 or 2 years out of residency, so it's not like you've been taking care of her for 10 years. But still in all, the point to emphasize here is that you haven't, it wasn't like you just saw her one time and, you know, one of your partners had tried birth control pills and failed, and you're like, hey, I got a hole in my schedule next week. Let's take care of this for you. I'm sure that wouldn't be the case anyway. But the point is, you know, you had usually several visits with the patient. You tried different medical management options. You know, this really was interfering with the patient's lifestyle. She understood the significance of having the hysterectomy. And most importantly, generally speaking, we're going to counsel against proceeding directly to surgery in a case like this if we were just meeting the patient or she hadn't been fully tried on alternatives. Other things to consider and perhaps mention, you know, you didn't think the patient was surgery seeking, like a Munchausen syndrome, for example. You know, she had real problems and concerns. She may be, let's go to the medical options. So again, we talked about a bunch of them. I didn't mention NSAIDs, of course, but that would be another one. Treatment options, we did talk about the laparoscopy. DNC is a possibility, you know, with the abnormal bleeding, because let's face it, if you find a patient has a submucosal myoma, and you take care of the submucosal myoma, if you're able to resect it hysteroscopically, you know, you may spare her the hysterectomy. And I would argue even if she has a polyp of any size, you know, again, you may take care of the problem by doing a DNC hysteroscopy and actually removing the anatomic source or the presumed anatomic source of the bleeding. So definitely want to consider that, the laparoscopy. And again, in this case, the DNC is probably appropriate with the abnormal uterine bleeding for two reasons. I mean, one, to make sure there's no hyperplasia, which I would agree with you guys would be unusual in a patient less than 30, but certainly not impossible. And then the other part of it, of course, would be, is there an anatomic explanation that you might be able to take care of with a less invasive procedure? Other things to consider, endometrial ablation. So would the patient be a candidate for endometrial ablation? Certainly we would, likely to reduce the menstrual flow and therefore the distension of the uterus and the subsequent cramping, which, you know, is associated with the dysmenorrhea. So that certainly might be a possibility. If the patient has fibroids, did you discuss and or consider a uterine artery embolization? And then similarly, if she has fibroids, a myomectomy. So, you know, we talked about the submucosal myomas, but we did earlier, if the uterus is quite large and she wants to spare her uterus, you know, you could consider a myomectomy. So, again, these would all be options to review with the patient and discuss and try to include in your discussion of your defense of doing the surgery on this patient. Again, the question is a general question. Your specific case obviously may be more, you may tailor your answer a little bit more to your specific case. As we discussed, if she's got huge fibroids, you certainly can try birth control pills, probably not going to necessarily do the trick, but certainly UAE, myomectomy would be relevant, in those cases. Endometriosis, again, the Lupron simulation might be appropriate, continuous birth control pills, Depo, or what have you. So obviously a little bit of this, you know, this is a general question, but you want to tailor it a little bit to the specific condition your patient has. And again, other things to consider adding, you'd say to the patient that above options failed or the patient declined them. The symptoms were disabling. Did she lose time from work? Was her activity limited based on the symptoms she was having? Was she Did it limit her ability to take care of her children, assuming she had them? And did it affect her marital relationship? So these would be things, again, that you would want to include, again, in your defense. We don't want to sound apologetic, but, again, we want to make the case that, hey, this wasn't the first thing I jumped to. You'll also want to include discussing options of definitive surgery. Did you consider, and we touched on this with the pelvic pain, did you consider other compartments, so other GYN organ systems, before you jump to the hysterectomy? Could the patient have had interstitial cystitis? Might she have had irritable bowel, but with abnormal uterine bleeding, for example? If you really are unsure of the diagnosis, again, considering a psych consult or perhaps a trial of an SSRI. About 40 to 50% of patients that have a trial of an SSRI with unknown cause of pelvic pain end up having some improvement in their pain. And then if you're really stuck, when I say stuck, I don't mean explaining this to the examiner, but if you're at a loss for what could be causing this degree of the patient's pain, did you consider sending the patient for a second opinion? That's always, if you did, that's always a great thing. If you send her to another doctor and they concurred with what your recommendation was for hysterectomy, it's kind of it's not a get out of jail free card, but it definitely boosts your argument and your defense. So again, hysterectomy is a reasonable option. Then certainly we could get into a conversation of which surgical approach you're going to take, be it abdominal, laparoscopic, or vaginal. That's a slightly different conversation. But to summarize, again, you want to make the point that it's certainly not your first treatment option for a patient that comes to you with these complaints, and it's unusual for you to do a hysterectomy on a patient this young. You did counsel her, and, she considered all other options. And, whenever possible, your preference would be to treat her conservatively, but there are situations sometimes where that's not possible. So hopefully you guys all got most of that. I am going to, since I don't know how to get people's hands up, I'm unmuting people, and I'll ask you to self-mute if you don't mind, if you don't have a question or if you're not speaking. But I'm in the process of unmuting everyone on the call so that people that do have questions or want to make comments can feel free to do so. Again, if you could put yourself on mute if you're not one of those folks, I would appreciate it. It just makes for less background noise. I'll have people unmuted in just a second. Sorry. Okay. Everyone, I believe, is unmuted. So if you do have something to say, or question or comment, please speak up. Anybody?
I have a comment.
Okay.
I have a similar case. I have a patient who was 23, and I did a hysterectomy for her. She had abnormal uterine bleeding and dysmenorrhea. And just like you mentioned, I tried almost every medical therapy option. Like, she didn't want to try Lupron because she said she wasn't comfortable with some of the possible side effects. And she ended up having, like, very little, like, adenomyosis on her final pathology. But I guess my question is, when you're presented with this case, when you have to defend this case, should you really kind of offer up a lot of those, like, details, or just kind of wait for the examiner to prompt you as far as, like, why you chose to make that decision?
Well, so, again, kind of depends on how they ask the question. If the question is something like, don't you think this is pretty young for, a hysterectomy, or if the question takes a more, I don't want to say accusatory, but puts you more on the defensive, how come you did a hysterectomy on this patient? That's where you kind of want to give a little bit of ground, say, when I was confronted with this, or not confronted, but when I had to manage this particular patient, you know, I found it really challenging. I agree. I thought that this was, you know, she was requesting a hysterectomy, and I thought this was young and extreme in this case, you know, but in the process of seeing her over multiple visits, you know, I tried A, B, C, D, and E. I offered her, in addition, F and find those treatment options. You know, did you do a laparoscopy on her before you did the hysterectomy?
I didn't do a laparoscopy. I talked to her about doing that. That was like my next step to really offer her. But then she had an IUD in place at the time, and the IUD had helped for, she said, about 2 months. And then the pain just was still about the same. It was still pretty severe, and it was kind of affecting her so much she had to take off work. So she was like, I just rather just have the hysterectomy. I'm going to have surgery at all.
How'd you do the hysterectomy? Laparoscopic, abdominal, or vaginal?
I did it laparoscopically.
Okay, so, and again, I'm not suggesting to be dishonest, but, you know, you could have, perhaps in your counseling, you know, you could have explained to the patient, hey, look, you know, I'm going to do this laparoscopically or attempt to anyway, so I will be looking in your pelvis if I find another explanation that's, you know, treatable or what have you. Again, I understand she may have still said take it out, but, you know, at least it gives you an option, the option of looking before you actually do the hysterectomy, even though that's done at the same time.
And that's one of the reasons why I kind of pushed for her to, like, because it was between laparoscopic or vaginal. And I was like, well, I mean, if I do laparoscopic, I can at least take a look and see and tell you if you, you know, had any endometriosis or anything like that. And she didn't, you know, but, I mean, she still wanted out. But I did, that's why, partly why I did it laparoscopically.
Had she had her tubes tied by any chance?
She had not, but she'd had one delivery. She had one child. And, you know, we talked about how obviously she can't have any more children.
Right. Again, it's definitely on the young side. At least she had adenomyosis, which will help a little bit in the defense of the case. And, you know, I think several of the things we mentioned certainly come into play here, not necessarily all of them. And to be quite honest with you, all the options, you know, in terms of medical options and surgical options, obviously wouldn't expect any one patient to have necessarily undergone all those treatments or, you know, less invasive surgical options. But the point is, in mentioning them, you know, you can certainly apply the ones that would be relevant to your particular patient.
Thank you.
Sure. I mean, the fact that she's missing work and stuff like that, the fact that you tried multiple options with her, you know, she understood that this was basically also, you know, sterilizing her, I think definitely will help, but are important points to bring out. Thanks for the question. Anybody else have any questions or comments about this one?
Hi, this is Tiffany Redfern. I have one question that kind of plays off of the same scenario.
Okay.
So as far as hysterectomy, I unfortunately, hold on, I'm so sorry. Let's go inside. I have a 41-year-old who had family history of ovarian cancer, but her genetic testing was negative. I was doing a hysterectomy for an endometrial mass, and this patient strongly desired the removal of her ovaries. She actually had gone into premature menopause that had already been worked up by another provider, and we had confirmatory tests that she was in menopause. However, obviously on my oral boards, having a 41-year-old with a BSO looks horrible. How should I respond or approach that, or is there just kind of no defense for that?
No, on the contrary, I think that's actually kind of an interesting case. I mean, look, if you were doing a hysterectomy on this patient for fibroids and that was it, she had no family history, and she just said, well, you got one crack at me, doc, I'm not coming back for surgery, take it all. And you're like, oh, no problem. It'd probably be a different conversation. But, you know, you said she had a family history. So family history of ovarian cancer?
Correct. Her mother had it, and then her great-grandmother on her mom's side had it.
Okay, so, you know, right there, you kind of have a, is your get-out-of-jail-free card. Very reasonable to do a BSO on this patient, even though she tested negative from a genetic standpoint. We don't know that if you had tested her mom or her great, which I think you said great-grandmom, you know, if the testing had been available at that time, we don't know that they would have been positive or negative. But there's definitely seems to be a familial preponderance here. Not, again, none of us can say with impunity, but definitely seems to, you know, be a family tendency here. So it would be reasonable for her. Look, it's not like she's 21 and you did a BSO on her, or even 30 to 35. I mean, she is 41 years old. So there, you have a reason to do the BSO, and I think you can defend it. Not all, you know, no one is suggesting that all the genetic conditions and or mutations that can lead to an increased risk of ovarian cancer have been identified. But again, it's not like it's her third cousin that had ovarian cancer and that's it for the family. These are, you know, direct, especially her mom, obviously, direct relative, first-degree relative. I guess, yeah. So the other thing I would say is, you know, it only helps you the fact that she had premature ovarian insufficiency. So she'd been menopausal for a year or two. Was she on hormones, by the way?
She was not. She was terrified of extreme anxiety, terrified of hormones with her family history.
Well, you know, obviously, in general, independent of your case, would be better if she were on them. But even putting that aside, you know, her being menopausal, not that the ovaries still may not produce some small amounts of hormones, though I don't know about patients with premature ovarian insufficiency. I haven't seen any data that suggests those ovaries, like a patient who goes through menopause in a typical fashion. I don't know that they do, and I don't know that they don't continue to produce small amounts of hormones. But that notwithstanding, it's not like she was a 41-year-old who hadn't gone through premature ovarian insufficiency and was having normal ovarian function. She already was compromised. So, again, I'm making up these numbers, so there's nothing about these numbers. But if somebody who goes through, you know, premature ovarian insufficiency, or let's say a postmenopausal patient puts out, and again, this is not a real number, 3% of the hormones they put out when they're not menopausal. And let's say that's true for a POI patient. Well, she's already lost the 97% by virtue of her being POI. So it's not like you're going from 100 down to zero. Do you know what I mean?
Thank you so much. It's very helpful.
Yeah. Did you understand what my stupid example with the three in the...
Completely.
Yeah, so this is, you've got justification for doing the oophorectomy is what I'm getting at, and the consequences for the patient should be less than they were, obviously, if she hadn't gone through natural menopause, especially since she's not taking hormones, but hopefully you'd be able to convince her anyway, either way. Thanks for the question. That's a great case. I wouldn't be afraid of it. I'd embrace it. Thank you. Anybody else have any questions, either about what we talked about, or if you have any questions in general, I'd be happy to take a different case or what have you. Again, everyone is off mute. You have to off mute yourself, however.
I have a question regarding how you select, how you do a hysterectomy in terms of minimally invasive versus open. Is it better if they ask you, well, how do you I have an abdominal hysterectomy on my case. If they ask, like, well, how did you decide to do an abdominal hysterectomy? Do you approach it as far as, like, well, I always attempt my hysterectomies through a minimally invasive route, ideally vaginal, but in this case, I converted to an open procedure because of the size of the uterus, or do you talk about the fact that you looked laparoscopically to see if it was feasible in terms of visualization, the census, size, and all that, and then I decided to open? Like, do you kind of just answer truthfully and say, well, it's a case-by-case basis, or when I'm counseling the patient, in the office, I say, look, I think that the chances of this being through a minimally invasive route are very slim. Most likely we're going to, proceed with an open procedure. Like, what's the best way to navigate that kind of question?
So, if it's a general question, then I would go with the approach that you mentioned. Whenever I have a patient that needs a hysterectomy, and deciding the route I'm going to employ, my preference would be to try to do it vaginally. However, if I find that the patient, for whatever reason, I'm uncomfortable or don't think I can complete this case vaginally, then I would go to a laparoscopic approach. And, of course, I would use my abdominal approach, I don't say as a last resort, but in cases where I don't think I can complete it vaginally or laparoscopically. Some of the criteria that I look for include, and then you go through, size, mobility, prior surgery, indication, are you worried she has cancer and you may have to stage her, which, would be take the vaginal route for the most part off the table, or would take the vaginal route off the table. It would have to be laparoscopic or potentially abdominal. So that's kind of where I would go if they were asking me in general. If they're asking about a particular patient, it sounds like this lady had fibroids. Is that correct?
Yes, that is correct.
Okay. So, some of it would be dependent on what your pre-op assessment was, either based on physical exam or usually physical exam in conjunction with the ultrasound. So if you're thinking, if her uterus is up to the umbilicus, again, some laparoscopic folks might try that, but usually they're going to have had extra training. You might say, hey, this was filling her entire pelvis and was this, a 20-week size uterus, and let's say the, uterine weight is 1,500 grams or something. Well, I don't think you need to necessarily scope that patient before you, proceed to doing an abdominal hysterectomy. On the other hand, if the patient's obese or there's some other limiting factor, maybe you do want to scope the patient to see whether, it's all uterus and whether maybe you could I'm air quoting here, get away with a laparoscopic, aka less invasive approach. So a little bit's going to depend on how they phrase the question and also the indication for the hysterectomy.
What if they come back, like let's say you counsel the patient that you think it's unlikely she'll be a good candidate for a laparoscopic procedure, and you will probably have to pursue an open procedure because of it. You suspect there's a lot of scar tissue from a C-section, and then you do an abdominal hysterectomy. What if they come back and say, well, why didn't you refer her to a doctor that does robotics or who's a better surgeon and can do it minimally invasive? Like, how do you get out of that?
Okay, so that's a great question. It really, again, a little bit of it depends on the situation. So where it gets tricky is if somebody does something that you don't do. So, for example, if you were I never recommend candidates, taking the exam, just volunteer, I didn't do enough vag hisses in residency, so, I don't feel comfortable doing them. Never volunteer that. You could get pushed into a corner maybe where you have to say something like that. But if they say, how come you did this laparoscopically instead of vaginally? I'm not exactly with your example, but go with me for a second. Again, don't say, well, I didn't do enough vag hisses. Usually there's an indication why you did it laparoscopically. Now, what I would say in your case is, if you really, really think that, somebody with just a little bit more training or, could have done it differently, then what you could say is, well, I talked to the patient about, and it usually comes up more with a vaginal hysterectomy, I'm going to make this up and you can see if it applies enough or if not, I'll try to address your question more specifically. But, if you had a patient, let's say, that had a 13-week size uterus based on your exam and consistent with ultrasound, and let's say you could say, hey, I said to this patient, I don't believe I could complete this hysterectomy vaginally, but there are surgeons that might. I'd be happy to refer you to, a colleague, in another practice who may be able to complete this vaginally. As long as you give the patient the option, you're on solid footing. You know, the case that if you do laparoscopic hysterectomies and you don't think you could have done this one laparoscopically, that's a much grayer area, because who's to say that the person who, you know, is going to use the robot necessarily is going to be able to do it any better. They may run into problems too and end up having to open the patient. So it really comes down to, it'd be like you doing, you know, vaginal breech per ACOG is acceptable. I would venture to bet everybody on this call would not electively do a vaginal breech delivery, myself included, electively. But, you know, if you have a patient that's breech and you happen to have an MFM, you know, in your hospital that is a vaginal breech, you know, expert, you know, certainly it would be reasonable to say to your patient, hey, if you want to try to do this vaginally, you know, I don't recommend it, but I can refer you to the MFM. Again, if we're talking degrees of laparoscopic, so in the case of the robotic surgeon, if we're talking degrees of, well, I could do it straight stick, but this is going to be too tough, I think it's going to be harder. I mean, I think there we're kind of blurring the lines a lot. It would really be more appropriate only in situations where somebody could do a procedure you couldn't do. And again, I don't mean minimally invasive versus not minimally invasive. If you did no laparoscopic hysterectomies, I think your point your concern would be more appropriate, if that makes any sense. Does that answer your question well enough?
It does. In my case, I did a diagnostic lap beforehand, and due to the orientation of her fibroids and her significant scar tissue, it wasn't feasible to proceed laparoscopically. So I'm just going to say that because, you know, that's why.
And that's very reasonable. I mean, there's a lot of folks probably on the call that have something similar, but certainly, you know, on people's list, that's a very common situation. Again, I think just to sum up, what I was referring to is, you know, if you had a patient that had, you know, third degree prolapse, she's a para 3, and they're all vaginal deliveries, and oh, by the way, the uterus is of normal size, you know, and you were not doing like a sacral colpopexy or the urogyne wasn't doing that, but it was just a straight hysterectomy, you know, how come you didn't do it vaginally? You know, that's where it gets to be something obvious like that. That's where it gets to be a bit more of a problem.
Awesome. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks for the question. Do other folks have questions? Doesn't necessarily have to be root of hysterectomy. Could be a different question if or defensive of a young hysterectomy. Could be anything you guys have. I'll try to help you.
I have a case.
Okay, so we'll, and then we'll get the other person next. Go ahead. Whoever said they have a case. Yeah.
I'm Eden. Thanks for helping us tonight. I have an abnormal uterine bleeding hysterectomy case I'd like to go over with you. She was 49, D2C2, came for heavy menstrual bleeding for years, had tried OCPs, Provera. Her periods were always a week or 2 weeks heavy. Her ultrasound showed a bunch of submucosal intramurals, 2-centimeter fibroids, a polyp. She really came to me from her primary care because she wanted a hysterectomy. Well, I did a endometrial biopsy on her that returned benign endometrial hyperplasia. So she had multiple things going on. We talked about treatment of each thing and having all of them together. Talked about hysteroscopy, BNC, polypectomy, but she, of course, had this hyperplasia. Also adenomyosis, I didn't mention, leiomyomas, all these things that cause her bleeding. So ultimately, she just wanted a hysterectomy and be done, which at the time I thought was reasonable. Well, I did it, and it came back stage 1A endometrial cancer.
Okay. She said adenomyosis. Okay. So which I guess, first of all, which obviously unfortunate for the patient, but what's your concern?
I guess my biggest concern is if she would have just had a polyp balloon, obviously the right treatment is a polypectomy. She had all the things going on. And this, the way that this happened, doing the TLHBS, and then finding out she had cancer, meant she had to have a second surgery to have her ovaries removed by a gynoc. I guess I feel like I was in the wrong, that I should have automatically done a polypectomy before anything.
Why?
Because of the benign atrial hyperplasia biopsy.
No, I don't. Respectfully, I don't agree with you. I think you did. I think you're fine. I think, you know, it was actually, the old better lucky than good kind of thing. And in your case, it was just better lucky for the patient. And it wasn't, when I say better than good, you did the right thing. I mean, look, if she had had EIN, I would have suggested that you should have done a DNC hysteroscopy for a bigger tissue sample. And even that could be debated by some GYNs. But she didn't. She had benign endometrial hyperplasia. The fact that she wanted a hysterectomy, given the fact that, I mean, the polyp, I'm going to throw to the side for a second. I mean, the polyp is one thing, but you told me she had submucosal myomas, she had intramural myomas, she's 49 years old. And, you know, hysterectomy, while wouldn't, if all she had was benign hyperplasia, you know, we would recommend medical management, or at least for board purposes we would. But when you tell a patient, hey, I got to put you on progesterone, you have a precancerous lesion, the chances of it progressing are, you know, 1 to 5%, so not likely. I'm going to put you on progesterone. Then I got to resample you, that cramp that you just had that you wanted to kick my teeth for. I'm going to have to do that again probably at least two more times. And we're going to have to continually watch that. A lot of patients that are healthy and, you know, are going to say, no, you're not. Let's get rid of it and be done with it. And again, even though our recommendation for board purposes would be medical management, it's not inappropriate. In fact, it's appropriate to offer them hysterectomy, albeit we would again recommend the medical management if they asked what our recommendation would be. So it's appropriate for her to say, look, I got all these things going on. Get it out. You know, there's no saying if you had done a DNC hysteroscopy polypectomy that you would have still picked up the endometrial cancer. I mean, you and I would both agree it's quite unusual that, you know, somebody with benign hyperplasia actually has two steps forward, so, you know, beyond the EIN actually and has cancer. But I would argue, and I understand why they did it, I mean, it's becoming, if she were younger, the oncologist, especially for a grade one, stage one A, may not have actually taken the ovaries out at this point if she were younger. She's 49, so different story. Mm-hmm. There is a move. There are some gynoncs that are suggesting, again, in younger patients, if they only have a grade one A, that they don't necessarily have to take the ovaries just now. You know, if the patient were in her 30s. So, again, I understand why that she needed the second procedure and why they did it, and you know, and that's reasonable. But, I mean, you know, why would you think, why would you have thought otherwise? I would have, you know, I think a reasonable GYN would not have thought to send it for a frozen section and would not have been concerned that the patient has cancer.
That makes me feel a lot better. I really appreciate it. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Again, if she had EIN, it would be a different conversation.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yep, I understand that. Thank you.
Thank you. That was a great, an interesting case. Somebody else was trying to speak, I think, before or with Eden. So did you have a question or concern?
Yes. How do you defend an operative laparoscopy for pelvic pain where you did fulguration of endometriosis, but you didn't take biopsies to confirm your diagnosis?
Well, why didn't you take biopsies?
Because I know it's a tissue diagnosis or a histologic diagnosis, but the you know, the findings, the visual findings were pretty, in my mind, diagnostic. But Dr. Shamroff said you have to do biopsies. Now, he said that you might get asked about it. And how do you defend that?
Well, so one thing you kind of can't say, you know, is the areas were oversensitive structures, because, you know, then why, if it were over the ureters, for example, you know, then why are you fulgurating it, which obviously you wouldn't have done probably. I think I would say, you know, look, classically, I mean, was her pain consistent with endometriosis?
Yes, it was.
Yeah, I mean, I think where I would go with this is this would be one kind of like what we talked about from the outset of the teleseminar. I would say that, you know, look, you know, in retrospect, you know, ideally I would have biopsied this. It didn't occur to me at the time so much because given her symptoms, I was expecting to find endometriosis. When I looked in, these were classic endometriosis appearing lesions. You know, and then you should be able to describe them, you know, they were powder burn or they were, filled with blood, whatever, you know, when you desiccated them. You know, so you want to be able to, you know, describe well. And, you know, but if they press you, how come you didn't biopsy? You know, in retrospect, I think it would have been reasonable to biopsy one of the implants and just leave it at that. I mean, you know, we're all practicing. That's why we call it practice. You know, none of us say, you know, what do you do? I'm a perfected, you know, OBGYN. I'm a practicing OBGYN. And again, it's hardly a horrible sin that you didn't do it. You know, unlikely to have any kind of impact on the patient's health. It's not like you, you know, did something careless or put the patient at risk. So, you know, I would just own up to it and move on. Thank you.
Thanks.
My pleasure. Guys, anybody else have a question?
Hey, it's Dr. Bracke. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks for chiming in.
Thanks for taking the time to review this with us. Had a young female nulliparous. The office sonographer had described a pedunculated fibroid about 8 centimeters. And she was complaining of heavy bleeding, and she wanted to preserve her uterus. We had offered her different medical management options, UAE, Acessa, et cetera, but she really wanted the myomectomy. So we took her to the OR, did an abdominal approach, and we didn't find anything. Subsequently, we closed her up. We did an MRI, and it was actually an intracavitary MRI or intracavitary fibroid. So how do you defend that?
That's a little tricky. So what did the ultrasound show? It showed a myoma, but you said it was pedunculated, right?
Yes, correct.
I mean, did the uterus look enlarged when you opened her?
It did look enlarged, yes, but obviously there was no fibroid there.
Okay, and I assume you palpated the uterus. You said you opened her laparotomy, so you palpated. I assume you palpated and didn't feel anything like intramural, right?
Yes, that's correct. Yep. So we closed her up, and I did an MRI, and that's when they described it as intracavitary.
So just out of curiosity, why did you not scope her first? And the reason I ask is if you thought it were pedunculated, do you think perhaps you might have been, let's say it really had been pedunculated myoma, do you think maybe you could have removed it laparoscopically?
Yes. I think given the size of it, we were just more comfortable with the abdominal approach.
Okay, was it, so not to put words in your mouth, but was it a mini lap?
Yeah, yes.
Okay. I mean, I think where I would go with this is, you know, look, it was clearly identified as a pedunculated myoma, appeared to be on a stalk. Did you happen to look at the pictures at all, just out of curiosity?
No, actually, we didn't see the photos.
Okay. You know, when I was very surprised, obviously, when I didn't see the myoma, you know, I palpated the uterus, and while it did look a bit enlarged, it could have been consistent with adenomyosis. Obviously, the patient wanted to keep her uterus, and given that there was no apparent myoma, I closed the patient. I didn't want to do any additional, I didn't want to do any harm to the patient. I mean, quite honestly, what would have been your other choice if you really didn't know it was intracavitary? You're going to start filleting open the uterus on the chance that you might happen to, you know, cut in the myoma and go, oh, here it is. I mean, you know, I would think that it was a misread or misinterpreted study. I mean, I think the hardest thing you're going to have facing you is, could you have scoped her first?
Sure.
And you know, it's easy to be a Monday morning quarterback. The scoping her first, if you didn't think that you necessarily would have been able to remove it, you could certainly make a case why subject her to the risk of a laparoscopy when I'm going to have to open her anyway.
Yeah.
You know, you could say in hindsight, yeah, it would have been great, but who knew I wasn't going to find anything? I mean, you know,
right,
it's not
right.
a common thing. And, you know, again, you'd be a little bit contrite about it, but it's not like you did something, you know, inappropriate. You acted on the information that you had. The patient was having symptoms and what have you. The only other question is, would you think that the pedunculated myoma would likely cause the abnormal bleeding, et cetera?
Typically they don't, but she was also having pelvic pain. So, again, I had every reason to believe that she had a pedunculated fibroid based on what we were told. So,
right. The old where there's smoke, there's fire. Where there's one fibroid, there's usually multiple.
Yeah.
So, you know, again, we would expect ultrasound to pick it up, but not if they were tiny. So,
yeah.
I think that's kind of where I'd go with it. And you can say, look, I felt badly for this patient. You know, we acted on the information we had, but unfortunately, you know, the ultrasound was misinterpreted.
Sure. Okay. All right. Thank you.
Sure. All right, guys, we are coming up on time. If anybody has any quick questions before we wrap it up, otherwise, as I mentioned, Dr. Shamroth will be back in 2 weeks again. But these were great questions y'all had tonight. I really do appreciate folks chiming in, and hopefully other people thought they were useful as well. Last-minute questions?
Do you have any tips on defending robotic surgery as the route of surgery as opposed to laparoscopic?
Sure. Let's see. So if you have robotic cases, the things that I usually suggest folks talk about, obviously you're driven by what you feel is best for the patient. Indications for using the robot, when you say robot, I'm assuming as opposed to a straight stick laparoscopic case. So if you don't have a skilled laparoscopic assistant, that would be a reason to do to potentially employ the robot. Obese patients, I believe, are also it's reasonable to employ the robot if you have a markedly obese patient. If you're anticipating a difficult case, so a patient, you know, with multiple prior surgeries, that's and you're anticipating you know, a lot of scar tissue, or if you're doing extensive surgery like oncologic staging or sacral colpopexy or something, you know, where there may be a bunch of suturing or a lot of dissection where not only the magnification but the dexterity that the robot affords you would be useful. These would be all indications to potentially use a robot.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Okay, guys. Well, again, thank you so much for dialing in and for the questions. some of you will be speaking with on Mock Worlds, and but I wish everyone the best of luck as they continue to prepare for their exam. Have a great evening. Good night.